After finishing his Ph.D. in biophysics at Cornell University, John Bloom did come to Biblical Theological Seminary, where he received his M.Div., and then decided to study biblical studies even more, and went on for a Ph.D. at Dropsy College of Hebrew and Cognate Learning, which later became the Annenberg Research Institute, where he also received a Ph.D. in Near Eastern Studies. John is very capable about speaking of the issues that he will be discussing today, and we look forward to his lecture.
I wanted to start off with basically a one overhead transparency summary of Perry's talk of last evening. This is a cartoon from Sidney Harris from about a year ago. It is, I think, a good summary of the whole origin of life problem. 3.5 billion years ago, two amino acids drift together. 6 seconds later, they drift apart. 500 million years later, two amino acids drift together. In other words, the standard scenario for the origin of life, where these things just naturally tend to come together, just naturally complexity arises out of nature to give you the proteins and so on that we see, doesn't really fall through, doesn't really work out very well. If you think about the amount of water that everything is in, all the other problems that Perry was bringing up. The reason I show this is because this points out and helps us overcome a fear that I see in a lot of Christian circles, and that is, if we grant the idea that the earth is very old, then we're giving evolutionists the mechanism to make life evolve, because we're giving them billions of years for these things to happen. The problem is when you work it through, you see that you can have billions and billions of years, and that's still not enough time to get the amount of information, the amount of complexity into organic molecules to give you any reasonable form of life. So that's the one thing to keep in mind on the origin of life issue itself. Now, if we move on from origin of life to look at starting from the first living thing and move on from there, that's really what I'm going to be talking about today. This is what we refer to as biological evolution. We looked at chemical evolution last night and the origin of life. Now we're looking at biological evolution, and really what I'm focusing on today are the problems in biological evolution. The reason evolution is such a hot topic is not so much the theory itself and its impact on biology, but a lot of its philosophical influence on mankind and on our worldview. And as Michael Denton has noted in his book, and I quote that here, it's in your notes as well, no other intellectual revolution in modern times, with the possible exception of the Copernican, so profoundly affected the way men viewed themselves and their place in the universe. In the Copernican revolution, prior to that time, man thought that he was the center of the universe. The earth was the center of the universe, of God's creation, the sun, and all the other stars and celestial bodies went around the earth. So naturally, man was at the center of God's attention, and, you know, everything fit. Copernicus said, no, it don't work that way. We're on this one planet, and the sun is actually at the center of our solar system, and we're just going around it. And then to extend the Copernican revolution further with telescopes and so on, we find that, well, we're on one insignificant star in a very large galaxy that's just a mediocre galaxy in an overall universe. Again, man's place in the universe has been shrinking as a result of the Copernican revolution. With biological evolution, a similar thing has happened. Basically, what it says is, instead of seeing a designer who has put all the complexity and who has put all the design into life that we see now, and especially man, everything that we see has gotten here by chance. It's not a deity who's working, it's been the roll of a dice. That's how we got here. Question is, is such a mechanism valid, and does such a mechanism really allow us to dispense with God? I should just say here that there's a lot of secular scientists. You know, the media likes to polarize issues. And they have, here's these radical fundamentalists on the one side, and then over here on the other side are these Carl Sagan types who, deny total existence of God, who, hate Christians and all this. The real scientific community, the average Joe scientist who works for Merck or something like that, is usually not off on that extreme. Many scientists will grant the idea that, no, there's a God involved in the sense of evolution. They realize origin of life is virtually impossible and so on. There's a God involved with it. So don't fall necessarily for the media thing that says every scientist is a flaming anti-Christian or something like that. I think most, I would probably use the term, most scientists would say, no, there's probably a God who's involved with it in some way. But from the philosophical side, does the mechanism really allow us to dispense with God? Or have we really found in evolution, at least at some level, what I call God's toolbox? I'll come back to this in the conclusion. But remember, we have a God in the Bible who uses means as well as just direct fiat miracles to accomplish what he wants to have happen. We talk about his providential guidance of our lives and of things going on in the world, and his control of history is some of what we see in evolution, in effect, God's providential guidance. But come back to that later. I'm going to look at, for the next 45 minutes or so, is how much of evolution that we hear about in textbooks, that we see in the media and so on, is really a fact. And where does the fact end, and where does the theory really start? When people try to explain the origin of the complexity of life that we see now. Again, the media would say that obviously evolution is an absolute fact. Anyone who would even question that notion must be some kind of a radical jerk. So just to calm our minds a little bit, I stumbled across a quotation from Norman John Barrell, who wrote The Origin of Vertebrates in 1955. This is from his introduction to the book. Really made me pause a little bit here. He says, there's no direct proof or evidence that any of the suggested events or changes ever took place. What strength the argument may have comes only from whatever wealth of circumstantial detail I have been able to muster. In a sense, this account, the origin of vertebrates, okay, is science fiction. But I have myself found it an interesting and enjoyable venture to speculate concerning the Cambrian and Precambrian happenings that may have led to my own existence. In these days of projected travel to the moon and Mars, I find a speculative journey into time more comfortable and less nightmarish form of escape from the inquietude of our present civilization. Evolutionists. These are the people who, look at us and say, oh, you guys have, your eye in the sky, and you guys aren't tied into reality at all if you believe there's a God and so on. Well, here's evolutionists saying, this is a nice form of speculation, kind of a fun hobby to figure out how I got here, maybe, but nice form of escape. So in a sense, we shouldn't feel overwhelmed or intimidated if someone says, why are you questioning such a solid fact as the idea of evolution? Francis Crick, in his book Life Itself, mentions the problems of regarding the origin of life. He says, an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, can only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle, so many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it going. So again, reasonable scientists out there look at the statistical odds on having this complexity arise and say, it's virtually a miracle. Now, they'll go on and say that it happened, so therefore we're here. But again, we shouldn't feel intimidated by the statements that it's a fact, and therefore we shouldn't be investigating it anymore. Critical issue in the evolutionary problem and in discussing it is to really define our terms, because a lot of baggage and a lot of error is slipped in under the door of definitions here and distinctions in words. The most general definition of evolution is simply that it is change over time. when Aldous Huxley says that evolution is an absolute fact, this is what he's referring to. He's referring to the very simple definition that it is change over time. The analogies he would use are, we're all aging. In an hour, we all get a little bit older. We're all changing. Therefore, evolution is taking place. It's a very obvious thing. That's fine. I mean, if that's all evolution was, then we wouldn't be meeting today. It wouldn't be an issue. Very simple definition of evolution, but when a person says evolution is a fact, this is probably what they have in mind. It's a very simplistic definition of what's going on. In a biological realm, the definition of evolution that you'll find in a textbook is this. Evolution is a change in the genetic makeup of a population over time. This is a very, again, very trivial, very obvious thing. If you take 10 million mosquitoes and you spray them with DDT, probably you'll kill about 9.99 million of them with the DDT, but there's a few that have an enzyme that mutated in them that allows them to metabolically digest the DDT so that it doesn't kill them. Those 100,000 of the 10 million mosquitoes survive. They breed. They replace the original 10 million population. And now if you come back to your mosquitoes after a few years of spraying, you have a DDT-resistant strain of mosquitoes. Why is that? That's because the genetic makeup of the mosquitoes has changed over time. That the few that were resistant initially to DDT have repopulated the area. So now you have 10 million DDT-resistant mosquitoes. The genetic makeup of this population of mosquitoes in this area has changed over time. That's biological evolution in the very general definition from a textbook. And again, that's something that we see. When we spray, when we use antibiotics, we're pushing evolution along in that sense of changing the population of organisms that are living, changing in effect their genetic makeup. Let's focus on this a little bit more tightly, though, because here's where the things are slipped in under the rug. And this is where textbooks really tend to make mistakes as well. They'll work with a very simple definition of evolution and stick a lot of things in with it. When they get technical, we refer to two different types of evolution. The one is microevolution, micro meaning very small. This other is macroevolution, very large-scale evolution. Microevolution is very similar to what I've seen mentioned with drug resistance or pesticide resistance. It's the idea that new species, new races can arise in nature by agency of this natural selection idea. This is the general Darwin definition of it. The two processes that are natural processes that are working to bring this about are, first of all, mutation. This is a change in those cookbooks that John was talking about last night. The DNA, the information that encodes what proteins are made, can be changed through, usually through damage or from radiation, changed through an error in replication when a new cell is made from the old material. You get mutations occurring in nature randomly. There are errors. But this puts some diversity into those cookbooks, some slightly different recipes, different amounts of spices or whatever in a protein that sometimes convey a selective advantage to the animals that have that slightly different recipe. If they're stressed, this is what we mean by survival of the fittest, if their environment is stressed, such as introducing DDT or something like that, then those which have the advantageous cookbook will survive. Those which don't will die, and we end up with, again, the population changing so that the organisms that have the better DNA or the better cookbook in this case are the ones that survive. Just a quick thing, what do we mean by species? That's a life form that they can mate together to share their genetic information, but they can't breed with anything else. So dogs are one type of species, cats are another. They can't interbreed with each other, so their DNA is isolated. Again, this mechanism of mutation, very tiny changes occurring in the genetic information, and then that change being selected through a natural process or through a man intervening process is a very valid mechanism from what we can tell. This is how we have domesticated and bred most of the foods that we eat in the animal and plant world. This is where goldfish come from. Goldfish are originally carp, which look nothing like goldfish, but the colors have been selected through a couple thousand years of inbreeding in China to give us goldfish. All the variety of dogs and, that we see are pretty much a result of that. Pigeons are an example of where show pigeons have been bred from the common Welsh rock dove or the 30th Street Station plague, depending on what name you want to give a pigeon, general pigeon. But just by selecting feather color or neck length or feather style, they've been able to breed various different types of pigeons through, again, looking at the variety that's there and then selecting a variety that's favorable to the eye or whatever, and then breeding that select animal. Darwin saw this on the Galapagos Islands with a set of birds, finches, that have become known as Darwin's finches. The Galapagos Islands are about 600 miles or so off the coast of South America. They're volcanic. They weren't there originally. So what they figure happened, how the island was populated with birds, was that some original ancestor, single bird pair or something, got floated in on a log or blown in from a storm. And then the original ancestor basically had a variety of habitats in which it could live in. There's some very desert islands on Galapagos, so the original ancestor developed a very heavy beak for going after cactus seeds. There's other types of seeds. One became more of an insect-eating finch, even developed the ability to use a tool, a twig or a branch, to dig grubs out of bark. You see a variety developing in this set of birds, and yet if you analyze their DNA, they're all related back to one original ancestor. Again, this is a small change that can conveys an advantage to one bird to be living in one environment over its cousins, and over time you'll get this diversity showing up. So this mechanism, another place it's been seen as well, is in the fruit flies on the Hawaiian Islands. Again, that there's about 600 or 700 species of these fruit flies, Drosophila, and on the Hawaiian Islands, again, they've analyzed their DNA. They go back to one or two ancestor strains that, again, blew in or floated in some way out into the middle of nowhere. And then, again, the fruit fly has, through cousins picking different environments that would be favorable to them, and through selection of DNA and so on, you've gotten them to the point where they can't interbreed anymore because they're so different. So this type of microevolution, to the point where you get new species forming, is really, again, say this is a fact. If we're going to come in on Monday and tell our colleagues evolution is a bunch of garbage, blah, 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 be careful, because microevolution has been fairly well documented. As a matter of fact, what you can say is microevolution is biblical, and this will really blow people away. Well, it's even in the Bible, after all. Where did all the races that we come from stem from? Well, from Adam for sure, and probably from Noah or somewhere in there as well. So again, we see in the Bible the idea that you have various races of mankind, which is a microevolutionary selection of skin color and body shape, dependent upon how much sun you're exposed to. That's what it really boils down to. White skin is favored in Scandinavian countries and Northern Europe. The darker skin colors are favored in the Near East and in Africa, depending upon how much ultraviolet light you have to shield in order to survive. So you see this selection of races, again, a microevolutionary thing that's dependent upon the environment that the people or the animals are living in. But what does the validity of microevolution really demonstrate to us? Does it mean that we should throw out the Bible? No. What it means is that the interpretations that were put onto the Genesis text that were influenced by the Greek philosophers Aristotle and Plato are wrong. back in Darwin's day, the general consensus was, again from Aristotle and Plato, that species were fixed, that in the mind of God there was an idea of what a horse should be like. That horse shows up in, you know, was created by God in that form and can never change because that's representing the ideal horse or the ideal horseness in some sense. Well, Darwin attacks that fairly effectively and shows that, no, through microevolution, there's a little bit of fluidity in that concept of horse. There's a little bit of fluidity in concepts of some birds. So this is the idea of a fixed species. It's made that way and can never change. Doesn't seem to be true. And what we can say then is that God has designed creatures with a limited ability to adapt to a changing environment. And I don't think there's anything in Genesis. Again, if we look at the diversity that the Bible shows us in mankind arising in really a microevolutionary way, that that's a statement that we can really have any problem with. That God designed creatures with a limited ability to adapt to a changing environment. Well, if this was all that there was to the evolution debate, again, we wouldn't have, you know, seminars and things like that here. Very clearly, very demonstrable type of phenomena. But as I mentioned, where the stuff is slipped under the rug is with the whole idea of macroevolution or large-scale evolution. As I mentioned, this is where textbooks sort of botch it, because they will go from microevolution and say it's by this mechanism that all life on Earth has arisen and developed. And this is, again, what we see, standard General College textbook. Here we have the evolution of the vertebrate classes. Start from a jawless fish. We go through a hypothetical ancestor. That's kind of nice to see that admitted there. Then we get various types of jawed fish. One of them liked to take strolls on land on Sunday afternoons. That became an amphibian, which became a reptile, which diverged into birds and mammals and so on. This is quantum leaps in complexity and in organ development and style. This is the thing that's being referred to as macroevolution, and it would be nice if the textbooks would make a definition between the two and say microevolution is one scale, macro is another scale. But again, the reason they tend not to do that is because they're drawing from the same mechanism. They will say that all these changes occurred by the result of small stepwise changes in the organism. This chart you have in your notes, and I got a little more sophisticated and added a couple things here to help explain it. It's really a time versus diversity diagram. Time is the vertical axis going on. Diversity is the diversity in the features of the animal that we see over time. We start with an original ancestor. We'll be thinking about vertebrates or something like that, so we'll call this here's our early first vertebrate animal, land animal. Well, this species started to live and then died later on. That's the length of this vertical line. Over the course of its life, some mutations occurred, and some of its cousins developed slightly different traits, and they lived for their own length of time, usually a little bit longer by assumption of the original. And gradually, through these minor mutations, you have new traits being acquired in the animal. This could be fur or feathers or something like that. And again, through this gradual change, one tiny mutation at a time, if you looked at the difference between one animal and the next on this diversity thing, they'd be very similar. But over time, give this millions of years, you'll get enough diversity being picked up that by the time you get up to A, B, C, D, you have very distinct animals. So this is the general idea. Again, very tiny, small, stepwise changes in single mutations, one amino acid changing at a time. We will get one gene changing at a time. We will get the diversity that we see today. Well, that's what we want to look at. What are the problems with this model, of diversity? The first one is fairly simple, and this is that it has not been observed. No one has wandered a beach and seen the squiggle come up on the sand, which generally gradually develops feet, which become hominid, and then it walks off. He forgot shoes here at the final step. But this sort of thing has not been observed in nature, these giant steps of development, mainly, again, because they say it takes millions and billions of years to accumulate these very small stepwise changes that give us the gross morphological changes that we see in macroevolution. So what that means is that what we're looking at when we look at life today is sort of like two frames of a motion picture. And from that, we're trying to interpolate back how these life forms arose and maybe make some predictions about what's going to happen in the future. But if you only saw one frame of Gone with the Wind, how could you really predict how it started or how it was going to end? This is the problem that we're facing here. We have the modern scientific method, which has found the microevolutionary mechanism and has tried to interpret the whole film of life on that basis. And what we're really doing is we're trying to solve a historical problem with contemporary laboratory experiments. I think there's a little bit of danger in that. Can you really solve or predict or analyze what happened thousands or millions of years ago on the basis of mechanisms that you're working with today? If you can, which in some cases you can with geology and such, you can do so, but you have to realize that you have a reduced level of certainty about your result. That's something we need to keep in mind. Okay, it hasn't been observed. It's very difficult to observe. The other serious problem with it is, again, it's an extrapolation. It's a very unbounded or unlimited extrapolation from this microevolution. And what I want to point out is that in other sciences, there's limits to how far one mechanism can be carried in predicting things. If we're studying the weather, meteorology, we can look at storm fronts and satellite photos and figure out the weather 2 or 3 days in advance. But you can't figure out the weather 6 months in advance because there's Earth rotation around its Earth rotation, yeah, right. The Earth orbit and other factors that are coming into account for long-term phenomena that affect the weather. In geology, again, there's a variety of mechanisms that affect the shape of the Earth, not only erosion, but continental drift. Magnitudes of time difference and also magnitudes of mechanism difference as well in other fields. Area I'm familiar with in physics, this is really evident. There's Newtonian mechanics that we use for designing cars, for designing microwave ovens, for most things that we work with, all works with Newtonian mechanics. And yet if we get very small, down to the level of dimensions of atoms, we have to shift over to quantum mechanics and take that into account. If we go over to very high speeds, up near the speed of light, suddenly Newtonian mechanics falls apart completely. We have to think in terms of relativity. How close are we to the speed of light? How does that affect time and mass and everything else? So again, in other fields, we cannot extrapolate one mechanism indefinitely. We hit barriers, we hit boundaries where other mechanisms come into play. So again, to extrapolate one mechanism, this microevolution, tiny, tiny changes, has the problem that we might hit boundaries that over which those tiny steps can't jump. Again, the top figure shows us the model of smooth microevolution. This is the idea that every day in every way, things are getting better and better. Again, one tiny change at a time, one amino acid, one gene being mutated to give us all the diversity that we see. And yet, what if in going between fish and dinosaur or whatever, there's biochemical complexity there that can't be generated in any easy, smooth pattern? What if you have to do incredible leaps in order to get between, in effect, boundaries between various animal types? This is the complexity that I think the microevolutionary scheme glosses over, is jumping between the major animal types. Well, it's one thing to mention philosophical weaknesses or potential problems to extending microevolution, let's take a look at some hard evidence for this, evidence of real limits to how far microevolution can go. First thing I'd like to look at is the whole idea of modern taxonomy. This is the idea where we can classify animals into various groups by their physical structure. The problem with modern taxonomy and evolution, especially macroevolution, is the fact that taxonomy works. It's basically that simple. The problem is that you can classify animals rather than have them all blur together. Just to give you a feel on what taxonomy is, this is all this Latin garbage that you see stuck on a common name for house fly or, you know, fruit fly is Drosophila, Madagascar, or something like that, and so on. But it basically looks and breaks down the structure or breaks down the features of the animal logically and says we have carnivorous animals here. They seem to have two types, with more cat-like features and more dog-like features. Within the cat-like types, there's further breakdown of cat and panther-type features, which ends up with cats, ocelots, lions, and tigers as the final animals that we kind of observe running around. But again, you can categorize animals by their physical features into these distinct types. This logical organization, if you will, of the diversity that we see. When you're studying fossils, you don't have living things that you can look at, but you can look at bone structure, and on the basis of various bone features, you can determine whether it's a mammal or a reptile, and piece things together in that way. Now, the problem with this, why is this a problem if it works for macroevolution? The problem is that the macroevolutionary model says that all that diversity that we see today, the ABCD, okay, up at the top, the cats and the tigers, or if you will, on the other side, let's make it cats and dogs or something, has all arisen from some original common ancestor, and all that diversity arose with very, very tiny steps of improvement from one animal to the next to give us the diversity we see today. But if you can logically tell C from D, and C and D had some common ancestor Y who blurred those features or maybe didn't have those features or had them in a more primitive fashion, then you couldn't tell C from D apart if you were doing taxonomy. If Y still existed, that would blur the features of C and D. Similarly, if Z still existed, that would blur the features of A, B, C, and D. So if you had Z around, you wouldn't be able to do your taxonomy very well at all because you couldn't have these logical categories as distinctly made as we see them in modern animals. As a matter of fact, if all these life forms existed, you'd have this big blurry mess. You'd have, you could have, you know, cats that could fly. You'd have, you know, dogs that would meow, and all these types of features that would get very confusing. So the fact that we have distinct animals today, A, B, C, D, is a problem for evolution because we have to say how could these distinct features come from more general, less diverse animals, and yet we can still logically separate one type of animal from another by distinct features. Of course, there's never a perfect argument, and there are what's touted to be transition forms where some of these features do seem to be shared. The trick is that these transition forms, the ones that make taxonomy hard, are very rare. An example is the lungfish, which is a fish that has amphibian lungs, so that when the lake bed dries out, it shifts over to breathing through amphibian lungs rather than gills. The platypus, cute little animal from Australia that lays reptilian eggs but nurses its young and has hair. So it mixes some mammal features and some reptilian features. The problem is that these are problems for evolutionists as well because they are a blur of modern features. In other words, it's a nice, fairly advanced reptilian egg. that the platypus lays, not some more primitive form of an egg. So you have a mixture. If you see a transition problem, it's a mixture of advanced features between C and D in 1 in 1,000 cases or something like that where you see a strange form, rather than some more primitive feature that you say, aha, this is a really showing us how the gap was bridged from C to D. So rather than seeing an animal type Y, when you have a problem, you see something that's a hybrid of really the features up in C and D. And again, it's not giving you a feeling for how that diversity could have developed. To Darwin, this was a real problem. And this was the major attack that was addressed against Darwin was, where are these? If you say it happens by every day in every way, animals are getting better and better, then where are the hundreds of thousands and millions of transition forms, the billions and billions, if you will, of transition forms that should have been there showing these tiny changes going from one type of animal to another? And Darwin had to say, well, they're not here. And where are they going to be? We have to say that none of those survived until today. We have to say that they would be in the fossil record. So here's our distinct category, A, B, C, D. You have to say every other thin stripe in here with less diversity, with more primitive features, had to have died out. The only thing that survived are the advanced feature animals that we see today. And all these intermediates are gone. That's a pretty heavy statement, and that's putting a lot of pressure on then the fossil record to come up with the evidence to show the hundreds of thousands of intermediates, stepwise intermediates, that are needed to demonstrate macroevolution by the microevolutionary mechanism. So that brings us then to the fossil record. Again, this is what Darwin pointed to. He said, we don't see this diversity today. We don't see the transition forms today. They're going to be in the rocks, guys, and let's go take a look. And this is what people have been doing for 100 years or so now. And it is interesting. We do see some improvement. If you look at the rocks versus their age, the type of animal that's living in the rock at that time, we do see a general improvement. You see prokaryotes before eukaryotes. You see mammals coming on the scene late. You see higher plants coming on the scene late and algae starting first and so on. You see general improvement from simple to complex. But the problem is that the intermediates that you need to have to justify microevolution aren't there. And this has been around for a while. George Gaylord Simpson in Temple and Mode in Evolution mentions this. He says, this regular absence of transitional forms is not confined to mammals, but is an almost universal phenomenon, and as has long been noted by paleontologists. It's also true of almost all orders of all classes of animals, both vertebrate and invertebrate. That's rather heavy. And Simpson is probably, in his generation, recognized as one of the top fossil studiers of his time. So, and here he shows the very tricky transition from reptiles to mammals and points out the problem that what you see is what's been termed abrupt appearance, where you have various classes, the marsupials, the insect-eating mammals, the rodents, more advanced mammals going on up. We follow them back in time in the fossil record. We get some bones, we look at it and we go, that's a marsupial, no problem. And then, bang, no more marsupials. So, and the first ones we see have the advanced marsupial features that we can recognize. Same thing with insect eaters and so on. We see a distinct class of mammal abruptly appear in the record and then continue on for millions of years with very little change in its structure. Now, that was written in 1944. George Gaylord Simpson, bring us up to date, Scientific American figure. Here you see it represented also, a little more realistically now. Various classes of mammals in the geologic column, in the fossil record going back, and they show this with dotted lines, with the thing just kind of fading out and so on. But again, all these intermediates, here's where there should be hundreds of thousands of intermediate animals to give us this diversity that we observe in the fossil in modern animals. Here there should be hundreds of thousands of fossils. There should be more stuff here in these transitions than we have up here in terms of diversity. And yet what we see is static, relatively static, at the macroevolutionary level, very static life forms, very recognizable, that appear abruptly. How we go from the squirrels, the rabbits, and so on, to some more primitive mammal, back the way down to some reptile, well, that's not there. We're not finding that sort of thing. Just to give you one nice example, here's the bat. 60 million years ago, Eocene bat, first one we found in the record. Any kid who's been on a farm would recognize this skeleton as a nice bat skeleton. A couple minor improvements or changes in 60 million years, but the first bat is a nice-looking bat. No idea how you made the transition to a flying mammal from non-flying mammals. How did that happen? Who knows? It's not shown in the fossil record. So that's the real problem that we have, is, again, the abrupt appearance, the transition forms that are really critical to have there aren't evident in the fossil record. Now, there's been a couple of transition forms that have been widely advertised to sort of bridge the gap, and I'd like to take a look at just one of them here for sake of time. This is an example of the horse. And once again, Simpson was very upset with the overuse of the horse because it was demonstrating not macroevolution, but some rather technical stuff instead. It was demonstrating microevolution by complex adaptive radiation. And he wasn't even too happy with that. He said there's several abrupt jumps and no uniform trends in the horse development, so it's really just micro at best. This is what you see in a typical textbook. We start with Eohippus, 60 million years ago, a little tiny thing about the size of a medium-sized dog that ran around in the forests and ate small trees and so on. Gradually, this animal increases in size, went from a pod type of a leg to the hoof that we see today, and other minor changes in the dentition and so on in size as it moved from a forest type animal to a grazing type of animal. Now, Simpson pulls out the full-blown detail in terms of what's actually happening with the horse series, just to say that it's been a little oversimplified in the textbook. Here's Eohippus back here and coming up to Mesohippus. And then when it makes the transition from a browsing animal in a forest to the grazing animal in the plains, which is where the hoof versus paw becomes helpful and some teeth change takes place, you see an explosion here in the grazing class of about 30 different types. See, it blows it up in this lower part. About 30 different species, different types of horse animal, of which one or two of those survive into more modern times, and really only one of those we see today in the modern equus. So this is, again, from Simpson's standpoint, not a demonstration of macroevolution, of fantastic changes happening. This is just microevolution as the animal is stressed and put into or diversifies into different environments. We see changes, small changes in its anatomy that favor grazing in pasture as opposed to roaming around on a forest floor, changes in the teeth as the diet is changed to grasses from leaves and fruits and so on. So these are the sorts of things that Simpson sees in the horse series, not a great proof of microevolution demonstrating macroevolution. So we have Eohippus turning into a modern horse in 60 million years, going through 10 genera and how many species of horse, no one's really sure because that's hard to tell. But yet, this is a very tiny change in an animal compared to what happened with a mammal going from land back to sea. A land mammal at about the same time, 60 million years ago, was going into the water to turn into the whale. So here's the horse. We have all kinds of transition forms and possible ways to follow how the horse developed. And even Simpson's a little nervous about that here and there, is that if that can really be all connected And yet we've got another transition happening with some other land mammal that's popping it back into the water, turns into a whale, yet no transition forms there. We haven't found any transition forms for how whales got back into the water, how mammals got back into the water to become whales. So again, what we see in the fossil record is microevolution. You see some nice examples of microevolution going on, where very small changes are documented by hundreds of fossils, lots of intermediates, but the big changes, we don't have a trace for how those happen. And again, the big traces should have even more fossils present for them than the little changes should have. So that's really the weakness when we appeal to the fossil record, is the lack of transition forms. And what appears to be the case is that we're using the exceptional cases, the cases of microevolution where we see that going on, to try to prove a general rule about how life arose. Well, no one likes to take an argument like that lying down, so the response to that is threefold. That the gaps in the fossil record are due to two or three things. First one is insufficient research. Darwin could appeal to this because fossils had only been studied for maybe 50 years in his time, but they've had an additional 100 years now to be looking for fossils, and we still are not filling in these gaps that we would like to see filled in. The second thing that's appealed to is the imperfection of the fossil record. Only one in a million animals that lives, they figure, actually its bones die, and rather than decay, they turn into a form of stone that is preserved. So therefore, need a lot of animals to be able to find a fossil for them. It's also a very chance event to actually find a fossil for an animal as well. The weakness with that argument, though, is the problem that I don't believe it's that incomplete. If you take a study on living land vertebrates that we find today, the cows and horses and all of that, and ask how many of the animals that we're aware of today do we find preserved in the fossil record, we find that it's about 80% complete. So modern animal, we'll find 80% of modern animals preserved in a fossil sometime back into the Eocene. That's why those vertical columns that I was showing basically are a demonstration of that. If we find 80% complete record for modern life forms, to argue that there's hundreds of thousands of animals out there that never happen to be fossilized gets to be very weak, if it's that complete for what we know existed, for the animals that we know existed. The third way to explain the lack of transition forms has been one that Stephen Gould and Eldridge thought up about 20 years ago now, and this is to say that evolution occurs in jumps. The technical term that they used for it is punctuated equilibrium. Here's the model that they had. Standard microevolution schemes, every day in every way, things are getting better and better, isn't really correct. What happens is that animals live in a very stable form, like what we see in the fossil record, the bats, 60 million years, you know, basically very stable fossils, live in a very stable form, and then due to a stress in their environment or something happens where they change very quickly, maybe 50,000, 100,000 years, you will have an incredible amount of change occur in the genetic material of this organism in order to bridge that gap up to the next form of life. And then it will stay in that form for a few million years, 20 million years, or something like that. And then again, in a very short period of time, due to glaciers or ice age or something, will stress the environment, pop another 50, 100,000 years, great stress on the animal, great genetic change, and then another stable plateau for it. And of course, because these changes are occurring very rapidly over short periods of time, we don't expect to find fossils for these transition forms because there were only a few and they only existed for thousands of years rather than the millions of years for the animals for which we actually find fossils. So this is Gould's punctuated equilibrium problem, or proposal to explain the gaps that people find in the fossil record. The problem with the Gould-Eldridge punctuated equilibrium is basically, once again, mechanism. They took this proposal to some geneticists, and basically the geneticists said, guys, you can't change DNA that fast. We really don't have a mechanism for how you can do that. If you want to say a miracle occurs, you can, but that's not, you really need to go back and be more explicit to bridge those transitionary steps that quickly. So that's been a problem with the Gould model, is that people don't have a mechanism to explain how the DNA can change that rapidly in animals. Enough of the fossil record. Let's move on to different world now. Another line of evidence that's come into play in the past 30 years or so, and this has been the chemical relatedness of various forms of life. Let's start here with our simple animal cell. You've seen this a few times. This little critter, as was already mentioned, is about as complicated as New York City. Probably a little bit more complicated, actually, in terms of what it can do. The one thing that they forgot to mention, though, is that this can replicate itself in 30 minutes. New York City cannot do that, okay, for which we should be very thankful. So, again, very, very complicated organism. What we want to look at are these mitochondria, the energy factories or whatever of the cell. These are the things that produce the ATP. Once again, it's a membrane-bound function. It's funny being a membrane biophysicist how that keeps coming up, but anyhow, the membrane function. One little protein in this chain of burning sugars in the body is an enzyme called cytochrome C. Cytochrome C job is to move an electron from one protein to another along the cell membrane. It's just a little shuttle bus, a little transport protein, and when they've analyzed its structure and blown it up, this is what it looks like. It's a ball and stick model. Each ball is an amino acid, and the sticks are showing the bonds. And this is trying to give you a three-dimensional perspective of what the molecule looks like. The very center is a heme group, same thing that's in your blood. So instead of transporting oxygen, this is what's moving the electron. And this heme group is protected by and held in place by a cage of amino acids. And the cage here has some fun features as they've discovered by looking at the cytochrome C for various animals. The beauty of this molecule is that anything that burns sugar has to have a cytochrome C in it. There's no other mechanism really for other than some fermentation processes. Anything that's got mitochondria and most bacteria have cytochrome C. You've got to move this electron between these two enzymes and anything that's consuming oxygen using glucose. So therefore, this exists. So let's look at 100 different cytochrome Cs in different animals, from bacteria through man, and compare them and see what we get. Well, the red balls here are amino acids that are the same on every cytochrome C that's been studied. At least I think they're giving you a group of 38 different species of cytochrome C here. All 38 have the same amino acid at this spot on the cytochrome C molecule. If a mutation occurred in the DNA that changed what amino acid that was, it wasn't a good cytochrome C, the animal wouldn't live, therefore it would die. So, and thus we wouldn't see that variation at that spot on the enzyme. But these other ones, as you go on through, and the purple are where the most variability is seen, is where the DNA changed, the amino acid changed, and you still have a reasonable protein. Still works, the animal still gets around. So that change gets passed on into its descendants, and here we have some variation in a simple protein molecule between species. Well, what Linus Pauling, and he was one of the first guys to work on sequencing on this before he got into vitamin C, what he felt was that you should be able to trace evolution through looking at the changes in the amino acids and in the proteins of animals over time. You start off with a very primitive jawless fish, and its cytochrome C has a certain sequence of amino acids in it, some of which change in the course of development over to fish, but most of them stay the same. And then as the fish evolves into amphibian, other amino acids in it change, but most of them stay the same. And you have this slow drift in the amino acid composition of the protein over the length of evolution. And you should be able to go back then and see and tie them together and say, aha, we see that mammals are more closely related to reptiles because they're the most similar, and so on all the way back down through the evolutionary chain. Basically, tracing evolution through the changes in the molecules in the animals. So this is what was set out to do. Unfortunately, it's really difficult to analyze the changes statistically or directly. So they've been boiled down to statistical tables, if you will, distance maps between the various types of animals. This is from the back of your Rand McNally, you know, the distance between Philadelphia and Los Angeles, and, you know, Philadelphia is here, and Los Angeles is here, and you tie the lines together to find the actual mileage distance. That's what this table here is, except this is the percentage difference between the cytochrome Cs of various animals. Unfortunately, man is not on here. He would be up at the top and would be 1 or 2 percentage difference from other mammals, very small. But you see basically here that between the plants, the castor bean plant, there's a 0% difference between castor bean and castor bean, so we're reading the table right. There's a 10% difference between castor bean and sunflower, 12% difference between castor and wheat cytochrome C. Okay, good, we've got that. Now, if we go outside of the plant family, then we see there's a 40% difference between castor bean cytochrome C and screwworm, an insect cytochrome C. There's a 40% difference between castor bean and horse cytochrome C. So this is the way the molecular differences are analyzed between animals and life forms. And the biology text will make very great emphasis of one pattern that's in here. That's what I call the vertical pattern. You notice here as you come down from horse on down to bacteria, you see an increasing divergence in the cytochrome C from top to bottom, from horse going on down. That parallels anatomy. You know, horses look the most different from bacteria. Horses look most like dogs, I guess. So the increasing difference in cytochrome C and in protein is parallels that in anatomy. And that's what is advertised in the biology textbooks. You'll see here they're saying human and chimpanzees don't differ at all. This is in leaf cytochrome C. Both differ by one amino acid from rhesus monkey, an average of 10.4 from other mammals, so on. This is an accurate reflection of the generally accepted evolutionary sequence of fish to amphibian to reptile to mammal. Okay, so this is one pattern that's there. This is the vertical pattern that is in it. And there's also an attempt to try to tie together the differences back into evolutionary trees or phylogenetic trees, where we say very few differences imply a common ancestor back in the past, and the more differences we see, the further back the ancestor was, so we try to construct some form of evolutionary table for the animals and the plants and so on in that way. Problem is that there's more than one pattern in the data, and this is been the real difficulty for people to try to analyze this. There's the simple vertical pattern that corresponds to differences in anatomy, but there's also an isolation between the groups that people aren't sure how to handle. I was pointing that out. Here within the plant family, you see that cytochrome C can differ at most only by a few percent, up to 12 or 13% between different levels of plants. Once you move out of that plant group, you get this pattern where there's an equal isolation between the cytochrome C for plants and the cytochrome Cs for all other higher life forms. Similarly, the pattern here within insects. Insects have been sitting by themselves, isolated for about 200 million years. Yet their cytochrome Cs have only diverged by about 13% at the most. And yet, once you get out of the insect class, boom, you see this uniform difference of about 20 to 25% between cytochrome Cs of higher forms. This kind of isolation between groups is something that Denton noticed and made a point of. Again, this is the cytochrome C. So there's two patterns here. The one pattern, which is the corresponds to the physical pattern, is the other pattern of isolation, which when you look at says the fish is equally isolated from other amphibians, from other reptiles, from other birds. And this carries out in other proteins as well. If you look at hemoglobin, again, any animal with a circulatory system for getting blood to the cells has hemoglobin or a close relative in it. If we look at jawless fish, there's an 80% difference on average, 70-80% difference between the jawless fish hemoglobin and the hemoglobin in jawed fish, frogs, chicken, kangaroos, and humans. What we would expect to see is an increasing difference between lamprey and carp would be very similar, and then lamprey and frog would be more divergent and so on, but the pattern isn't there. There's an isolation between classes that people weren't really expecting to find. And what does that mean? That's a good question. From the secular side, they have not come up with a good model to explain that the type of isolation that's seen between the classes. Okay, to summarize where we're at, the evolutionary problems. First of all, we expect types to be blurred or indistinct. And again, this is similar at the protein levels what we had at the anatomy level. Why is it that some proteins have remained distinct and isolated at the class level? To give us our famous chart again, let's imagine this is insect cytochrome C here. And in the cousins to insects several hundred million years ago, there's animals that are evolving and turning into mammals and reptiles and so on and so forth. But the cytochrome C here for the insect is kind of stuck and doesn't change. In fact, all the insect class kind of stays about the same for 200 million years, while the cytochrome C in other animals is changing and doing all kinds of great things. So you have this problem where proteins are staying stuck, they're not changing significantly for a couple hundred million years, while their cousins are evolving in some other animal. So again, it seems to imply that there's some sort of boundary or envelope of some type that limits insect proteins to be staying like insect proteins, insect DNA to be staying like insect DNA. The other trick is going back to that picture of cytochrome C, if I can dig it out quickly, probably can't, is the most critical parts of the molecule are the ones that are staying the same. Remember the red balls here are the ones that are the same in every species analyzed? Because it's figured if those change, then the protein doesn't work anymore and the animal dies. Well, if you take an average of the constant amino acids in proteins, you end up with about roughly 30% of the amino acids in the proteins that have been studied are the same in every animal. If it's cytochrome C, there's 30% of the amino acids are going to be the same in any cytochrome C that you study. Go to hemoglobin, there'll be a different percentage because some molecules can vary more than others. But on average, they figure it's about 30% of the amino acids have to be in that spot for that enzyme to work for you to have a living animal, because they don't change when you look across various species and so on. What that does is it says that you have to have cytochrome C defined to within 30% of its sequence, or an enzyme defined to within an average of 30% of what we see today for it to even work. So your first cell, this real primitive cell, had to have 30% of its information intact for it, or 30% of its information the same as what we have in it today for it to work. So the origin of life people have to have 1/3 of modern complexity there in your first cell. Okay, you think about that. You have 10^9 bits of information. 1/3 times 10^9 have to be in your first cell in order to have enough information for the enzymes to work. So your minimal functional cell, your minimal functional enzyme, is so complicated based on what we see in studying the modern forms that to say that that evolved, say that that got there by chance, becomes incredible. So that first rung on the ladder is being made push higher and higher by the more that we know about conventional living cells, conventional enzymes. The other trick is that the variation that we're seeing in cytochrome C is what they call neutral variation. It doesn't affect the way the thing works. We're not demonstrating that every day in every way it's getting better and better. We're demonstrating that you can paint the walls a different color and it still works. We're getting some neutral variation in the proteins, not an improvement in function or not an improvement in something that's really tangible in these cases that we're looking at. Stealth cytochrome C from bacteria up to man, 30% of it is the same. Then I believe I basically mentioned this already, was the living fossil problem. And this is, just to give this back to you, here's your DNA in some living fossil, be it an insect or a lungfish, been around for 200 million years. That DNA, or that cytochrome C, is basically staying the same, and yet its cousins are evolving through amphibian reptile stages to become mammals. So here we have DNA and proteins that are changing like crazy. We have other DNA and proteins that are staying the same, or at least not changing the outward appearance of the animal over 200 million years. So again, we end up with the problem that one set's evolving and the other set's not, and yet they're both changing. How do you work with something like that? So again, the problem is that the biochemical stuff has shown us a lot of things. It's shown us, again, how complicated life is, how difficult it is to get the first thing going. It shows us neutral variation, but it's not showing us the macroevolution that we need to see to really verify the theory. The last area I like to look at, and because I'm sort of an engineer at heart, I guess, I enjoy this one. This is the engineering problems in life to get things going. And the point here is we have coordinated systems. We have Calvin cycles biochemically, Krebs cycles, and coordinated systems of enzymes that are difficult to change one mutation at a time and still have the requirement of fully functional intermediate. Remember, this is really critical, and this is why I've been saying it several times. Every day, in every way, it's got to be getting better and better, because macroevolution assumes continuous improvement. Every change that happens in the animals that survive has to help the survival of the fittest, has to be a benefit to the animal. The other thing is it has to be fully functional. It can't cripple the thing for one stage and then turn out to be a benefit several generations later on. It needs to be a continual improvement in order for survival of the fittest to be the driving mechanism for it. There's a lot of examples you can look at of this where the sheer engineering, the sheer logic of trying to figure out how you could change something one step at a time is a problem. An example that I like is the bacterial flagella. Now, these are the little hair-like features that come off of E. coli and various single-cell bacteria. Remember, these simple single cells. These have been around for 3.5 billion years or so. And they've had this little flagella that helps them find each other so that they can have DNA swapping parties. It helps them to find food and get to an environment that's cooler or whatever. So they need to be able to move. And the way they do it is with these flagella. And about, 10, 15 years ago, they finally figured out how these flagella work. They have the only rotary motor that's ever been found in nature. These things actually spin like the screw on a propeller to drive the bacteria forward. And there's this little There's an electron micrograph here of it that doesn't show up very well, showing you the proteins that are forming it. This is a more detailed blow-up of it here. Basically, there's several proteins. There's a bearing and a stationary part of the motor protein, which is in the cell wall, through which a shaft protein goes, and on which at the top there's another set of proteins that's the rotor for the motor, the spinning part. And after you get through the rod and out into the cell wall, there's a universal joint protein here that gives it some flexibility. And then finally you get the long filament protein, which is the actual propeller part itself. All of this is hollow because the filament grows at the end. The proteins are, monomers are spit out through the hole, out to the end through which they bind and form the, make the flagella grow at the very end. So this is a whole nice cluster of proteins here. Now the other thing that it does is it's bidirectional. If it spins one way, it drives the cell forward. If it spins the other way, it causes the cell to tumble, and by kind of tumbling and waiting until it's pointing the right direction, it can steer itself. So again, a bidirectional rotary motor in a bacteria from 3.5 billion years ago. Okay, fine, great, good, okay. Now, we're going to improve this. We want to make bigger bacteria. We want things to get better in every way, so we need to increase the horsepower of this motor. So what we need to do first is we need to increase the shaft size of this bearing, because you know, you got to get more torque through it out to the flagella. So we're going to increase the shaft size, so we mutate, and voila, we make the shaft big. It sticks, right? Because it has to be honed, just be the right size to fit through one protein to the other. What we'll mutate first then is we'll mutate the bearing protein, whoops, in the wall to make that bigger. Fine, okay, we make that nice and big, and then all the guts of the cell leak out. Okay, So again, here you have a system where in order to improve it, let alone get it in the first place, okay, you have to change several things at the same time, just from an engineering standpoint, in order to get that improvement to happen. You have to have a coordinated change of several proteins at once in order to see the enhancement that you really want to have going on. And this kind of example can be pointed out again. Once we understand the complexity of what's there, you keep hitting example after example of this type of complexity, where you end up with things that are just too difficult to change one bolt at a time. The example I would have for that is the poor college student who's trying to turn his Volkswagen into a Cadillac. This is actually a Lincoln Town Car, but anyhow, for analogy. He's heard that scientists have been able to change hubcaps in the lab, so what he figures he can do is take his old VW and change it one bolt at a time, because, you know, he's working a job, he's got to study, and he also has got to get to school next day, right? So he's changing it one bolt at a time into the Cadillac that the college president drives. So he goes to the junkyard first day and he buys a fender, the left fender from the Lincoln Continental. So at that night at home, he takes it off, and it doesn't fit too well, but at least it goes on. Okay, he's replaced the fender. He can get to work next day. He can get to school next day, no problem. Next day, he goes and he buys a tire. Now, he's got an American 5-bolt tire that's about twice the size of a VW 4-bolt European tire. And he goes, now, how do I get that on here? Okay, I can only change one thing at a time because I'm too poor to be able to afford to buy more than that. I don't have the time to change more than that. Plus, I got to get to school the next day with this thing. There's too many constraints here. I can't change one thing at a time and still have the fully functional intermediate. Now, we haven't even gotten to the 4-cylinder air-cooled engine in the back that turns into a 8- or 6-cylinder front drive automatic transmission with air conditioning in the front, one step at a time, and still able to drive it, and still able to get around. In fact, even to be better than what I had before every step of the way. This is the real philosophical problem or engineering problem with the evolutionary hypothesis. How is this addressed? The best explanation I found is that we're limited by our imagination in thinking of the intermediate steps. Okay, an honest admission, but if you're going to have a theory and if you're going to claim it's a fact, you need to have a mechanism. You need to have a mechanism that you can demonstrate works that helps you over the logical hurdles of engineering and improving complex systems. See, if you view life as a simple thing, you can do simple changes on it. When it gets to be complicated, however, that's where the problems come up. Now, Gary Larson has proposed some mechanisms for how animals overcame various life-stressing problems, how the first things got on land, for example. So, again, the real problem is that if we don't have a mechanism for it, how can we say that this is really solid and established? So let's start to summarize here. First thing we need to step back and realize again is microevolution, the tiny, tiny changes that we see, is a fact. That we can demonstrate. We also have the problems or the things that we've learned that there's a common genetic code. The cookbooks all have the same alphabet. They all speak the same language. And there's a common protein structure in general for all life. You know, 30% of the cytochrome Cs are the same in every living animal from that standpoint. So again, there's that commonality there. There's that microevolution that we see. We do see in the fossil record a general development from simple life forms up to more complicated life forms. What's the purpose of that in a creationary scheme? I would propose perhaps that it's God using simple life forms to make the earth more inhabitable for the next stage of life. And he has a stage of life. Basically what you see in a forest after a forest fire. Everything's burnt down. You get trash trees and shrubs that come in and prevent erosion. Grasses come in. But gradually you get the hardwood forest developing as the more mature and solid trees come into it. I would say that's possibly the scheme that we see happening in the origin and the development of life on the earth when we view the fossil record. The simple to complex is that it has an ecological purpose in making the life a habitat fit for, finally, for man. The trick, though, is to say that macroevolution is true. We're doing so by purely natural mechanisms. That's where the unjustified extrapolation is. And that's where if you come in and say on Monday morning to someone, I think evolution is washed up, make sure you say macroevolution. And the problem is that it's too much of an extrapolation for it. Another point I should add in here, too, is that we don't have a mechanism for making the complex transitions. And that's, you know, sort of a subset of three. We have no mechanism to make the complex transitions in biochemical systems that are needed to have macroevolution have really occurred by itself or occurred naturally. At least that we're aware of at this stage. Fourthly, should just point out this is not really a religious issue. Again, the media likes to do this and, you know, play up towards the religious fanatics against the factual cool scientists. But there's many agnostic scientists out there who are very skeptical of the macroevolutionary theory. Shapiro is an example in his Origins of Life book. He's an avowed atheist, no problems, or at least an agnostic. Denton, Michael Denton, is an agnostic. There's guys out there who are good scientists that say, wait a second, there's problems with this theory that we can't buy, and let's not cloud it by evoking some religious issue, you know, to gloss over the problems. Fourthly, or lastly on the summary, I just say, I think what we have happening here is science is going out of bounds. It's turning into a game in studying some of these things. When it gets beyond the mechanisms that we see going on today, it turns into a game to try to explain history using only natural means. Very similar to what liberals were doing with the Bible and the New Testament and such, to try to explain away all the miracles using only natural means. The models that you end up with, you know, Jesus only really passed out on the cross and didn't die and all that, end up really being kind of ludicrous. But yet, if you're going to stick with no miracles and only a natural explanation for what happened, you're forced into that kind of conclusion, even though it's a ludicrous model. And that, I think, is what the weakness in what science is trying to do here. They're getting beyond natural cause, trying to explain history with only natural cause. So, why is evolution believed? Again, microevolution is true, and the jump to macroevolution is then assumed to be possible. Again, the limitation here is in naturalism. No explanation other than evolution is considered to be scientific. This is a fun thing. You talk to some scientists, and when you start to mention supernatural, you get this, you know, fear shows up on the eyes, because, again, the definition of science is we are only seeking natural causes for what has happened, and if we evoke a supernatural, then we can't do science anymore. And this is the problem with it. The trick is that then you'll end up with the problem that any natural explanation, no matter how impossible it is accepted and preferred to one where you say, well, there's probably a supernatural cause here. And this is the limitations, I would say, more in the philosophical aspect of what people are doing, not so much in the scientific method per se. But again, it's the naturalistic limitation. And I would just point out a couple of fallacies in that. One is the notion that if God is involved, does that mean that science can't investigate it? Don't we think God is involved in the weather, in ordering our lives, in what happens to it, and yet we study the weather, we try to predict what's going to happen. So just because God's involved in doing something doesn't mean that science has to back off and can't study it, because we have, as I mentioned at the beginning, we have a tool using God. He uses means to accomplish his ends through providence. And when we're looking and we're studying things, even in this case, can some of the diversity that we see have occurred through microevolutionary means? Could God have used that as a tool to accomplish his ends? So we can calm our scientific friends by saying, no, it doesn't mean that you can't investigate it, that you have to back off, because God uses means as well as direct miracles to accomplish his ends. The other problem from the other side is we often feel that if man can explain how it happened, then God isn't needed. I think this has been one of the big driving forces behind evolution from the secular side. This gives us a reason to not have to have a God involved in our origins, in the functioning of the world. And if he's not needed, then why posit him? Why have him? And there's various responses one could make to that, but one that I've thought of here is that just because man has found the paintbrush doesn't mean that we don't need the artist anymore. You know, we found Rembrandt's paintbrush, therefore we can explain how the paintings were done mechanistically, therefore we don't need an artist to oversee and use his skills through the paintbrush to make things happen. So that would be an analogy, I think, to use with people who feel that, hey, we have a mechanism and a means, we don't need God anymore. Another reason why evolution is so well believed is because it's very difficult to disprove. It's a very powerful method of saying anything that we see out there we can explain through this small mutation process. It's almost a too powerful mechanism, and therefore it's difficult to come up with a test case that says, do we have something that we can prove evolution wrong because we see this? It's very difficult to disprove it. Convergent evolution is an example of that. You see several cases where the eye has evolved independently in very isolated life forms. You have trilobites over here that develop an eye. You have some other land animal that develops an eye independently. They call that convergent evolution because the eye shows up in two different places and they look alike. Rather than saying, wow, if we see this happening in two different places, that doubles the odds on it happening, they say, well, that shows that it was twice as likely to happen because we see it happen in two different places. So it's a very powerful explaining tool, and no matter what the data is you throw at it, you can justify your conclusion. And lastly, and I don't use this, please don't use this on your scientific friends, but it becomes a model for some people to justify an irresponsible lifestyle. Aldous Huxley and his philosopher friends used this approach and really jumped on the bandwagon with Darwin for this approach. He said, for myself, as no doubt for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness, which is a direct result that we're all here by chance, was essentially an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system, that's capitalism, by the way, and liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. We objected to the political and economic system because it was unjust. Of course, communism was even better. The supporters of these systems claimed that in some way they embodied the meaning, blah, 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 of the world. So some people have an ulterior motive in running the evolution bandwagon. In other words, they have, men need to rationalize sin. Why can I continue sinning? If I can say that, hey, science says there's no God, I don't have to be responsible to any God, then I can keep on doing and going the way I am. Again, not everybody uses this approach, so please don't use it on people, but just be aware that it's there, and that's part of the emotional appeal, if you will, to the evolutionary model, to a sinful mind, is the fact that there's no one I have to be responsible to. And that allows you, again, to jump over great leaps of naturalistic problems to get to a conclusion that you like. And that's his problem. So in summary, what do I want to say? First of all, we don't need to be afraid of the raw data that scientists are finding. Okay? What we need to watch out for is some of the interpretations that are being put on that data, because those have blinders and so on. But the data itself is not really at odds with what we see happening in the Bible in terms of the creation. And what I would propose then is the basic model that the data from nature and the data from the Bible have the same author. The God who wrote the scriptures also created the world. So we should be working with the same database. And our interpretations of either set of data might be at fault. We might have to modify our interpretation of natural data. We might have to modify our interpretation of biblical data on occasion. But the data should harmonize. And this is really the philosophy, I guess I would say, of IBRI, is that we want to take the biblical data and natural data, look at them together, and try to come up with what seems to be the correct model and the best model for how God is actually working in the world and has worked through Scripture and through his both forms of revelation, natural and special revelation.